Kia ora and welcome to this episode of Better Off Read, where I, Pip Adams, speak with Ranavan Ngainalingam about his new book, A Briefcase, Two Pies and a Penthouse. This is a cutting and hilarious satire. I know that sounds like the blurb on the back of the book, but that's really what this is. It's very funny, and it sort of points its satirical focus at New Zealand's surveillance bureaucracy, which does a very good job of doubling as an old boys' club. It deals with serious issues, but I tell you, it's a great antidote to what ails you. This government will bring you down, down, down. This book will cheer you up, up, up. So this book is published by Lawrence and Gibson, who are an independent publishing company here in Wellington. Their model for publication is quite different from a lot of other places. So this podcast begins at Rebel Press in Trades Hall, where I met with Bran and Murdoch the day that they were putting together the book. And when I say putting together the book, I mean exactly that. From scratch, they printed it out, guillotined it, crimped it, glued it, and made books. I found that really exciting and interesting to watch an author sort of engage with the labour of producing a book. It was great. This book is being launched at 5:30 on the 3rd of June at 17 Tory Street here in Wellington. That's 2016. So if you are listening to this in 2020, I'm very sorry, but you've missed the launch unless you have a time travel machine. Do you have a time travel machine by then? I really hope so. Anyway, so the launch includes music by Ruth Mundy and Vaughan. They will both be performing. That's another great thing about Bran's book launches. There is often exceptionally good music. There's always good music. The Pegasus bookstore is also having a poetry reading straight after, and they're going to start slightly later, so you can actually go to the launch of A Briefcase, Two Pies and a Penthouse and then head down to Pegasus Books and see that. So what more could you want? Just do it. I just need to also thank Ruth Mundy and Vaughan because they've let us use some of their music in this podcast. I think the first music you'll hear is from Vaughan, and then we finish with a beautiful song by Ruth Mundy. The podcast may sound a little different this episode for the first time ever. We went and purchased a microphone from Music Planet, who were extremely helpful. They did not pay us or offer us any gratuity or anything like that, but they were just extremely helpful. So yeah, if you're interested in making podcasts and you're not sure where to begin as far as gears go, you could do a lot worse than going to Music Planet here in Wellington. They were really helpful, so thank you very much. So yes, this podcast has everything. It has politics and satire and bookmaking, and also my favourite bit is that during my conversation with Ranavan, you will hear the dulcet tones of Branavan's incredibly intelligent daughter, who found the book very funny. You will hear her laughing a lot, and she laughs and laughs and laughs, and in the show of quite possibly the best parenting I've ever seen, Branavan simply picks her up, gives her a hug, and she's off to Moi. She's amazing. She's just like, Moi, Moi, baby. Beautiful. Anyway, thank you very much for listening, and I hope you enjoy it, and get along to the launch. Woo! Hey, Ranavan.
How's it going?
I'm really good. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Awesome. It's not very cold out there. It's quite a nice day. It's quite wicked. Which way do we go?
We go upstairs.
Oh, wicked. Awesome.
Have you been?
Yeah, I've been to Trades Hall a few times.
Yeah.
It's quite a cool place, eh?
Yeah.
I really like it.
I like the old school lift.
Yeah, the lift is almost terrifying.
Yeah.
Pretty good. So how long have you guys been here?
For about an hour.
Oh, nice.
But we spent some time last night printing and getting that stuff ready.
Yeah, how long does it take in all?
Depends on whether we kind of get our groove on, but it can take a day.
Yeah, yeah.
We do pretty small runs, so.
So how much is this run? I don't even know the technical thing. How much? 60?
160.
160?
Yeah.
Whoa, that's a lot of books. To make from scratch.
Oh, it's not too bad, because you print them out four at a time, so.
Ah, sweet.
You just end up having to guillotine.
Ah, sweet. I see. Thank you so much.
Straight ahead.
Straight ahead. Oh wow! Look, this is awesome. Cool. Hey, Murdoch. My recorder's on.
Ah, well, no comment.
No comment. No comment. Okay, so, Ranavan, where are we?
We're at Trades Hall in Rebel Press's little office, and we're making our book.
Cool. So you were saying you're making about 160 copies, is that right?
Yeah.
And so can you describe the process really? I think I know what's going on. Do you want to explain it?
Sure. So we usually spend a lot of time printing first. Murdoch comes in early and prints a whole bunch. But because of the curve of the paper, he has to print half of them one way and then half the other way. And then I have to splice the two halves together. So each book has half its pages from the books curving one way and half books curving the other way to avoid them having curved spine. So that's my job at the moment, of splicing. And then once we do that, I pass it to Murdoch, because we print them four to a page, and Murdoch guillotines it down. And then the next step will be to guillotine it down further to A5 size, and then it's glued together with the cover, which has been crimped, and then we guillotine it down further and wait for the glue to dry.
Awesome. So what does it mean as a writer to be in here making your book like this?
It's great kind of feeling that you're part of the the mechanical process, I guess. It's kind of like you're owning your means of production, and yeah, it's kind of also, I was heavily inspired by a lot of the DIY musicians around town, and the fact that they, and around the country, who just get on and do it and make it themselves, and it's that kind of vibe, which it's great to be part of.
Yeah, it's just really nice being in here as well. There's a really nice atmosphere as well. So what does it mean to be publishing with an independent publisher as well? What does that affect? I guess it doesn't affect how you write, but can you talk a little bit about your decision to go with an independent publisher rather than one of the bigger publishers?
Well, I mean, they took me, for starters, so that made the initial decision. But also, I like the freedom that that I have, and Murdoch is a great sounding board in terms of thematic ideas and suggestion of books and all that sort of stuff, and he's willing to take a few more risks with subject matter and being books that are political, and there's a kind of community. It is not just us writers, but designers and editors and musicians who play at our launches, and so we kind of, that's a bit more inclusive, which is a great thing to be part of.
Yeah, about the cover, like the cover looks amazing. How do you design the cover? How do you go about designing the cover?
So we have a guy, Paul Neeson, who we usually use, I've used in my ones. I know Thomason's used Judith Carnaby, I think, for her one, but Paul's done three of my four books, and he does it for Whiskey and The Love of It, and I think he's amazing, and just really hardworking, and just kind of comes up with these great visuals for the books.
It's so true, and I mean, it's really nice because your books, like, I was looking at them all on my shelf today, and they sort of look like, do you know what I mean? Like, it's just this really nice, not that all of them are the same by any measure, but there seems to be a kind of aesthetic to them, which is really nice.
Yeah, and I think Paul has a kind of sensibility to what he does, and it kind of comes through. Because his first cover, which is just over there, because Murdoch's had to do a few reprints, is much more simple, whereas the last two have been quite detailed in terms of landscapes, and yeah, I just think he helps really sell the book in terms of random people looking at it.
Yeah, I think it's totally true. Yeah, I love getting under sales cover. It's so great. I think I can probably let you get back to work. How long will it take you?
Probably the whole day. We usually break for falafel at lunch. We have a kind of traditional, we might be breaking the tradition this time because we usually go to Abracababra, but falafel fellas might be calling because their falafel's pretty good.
Yeah, it's so hard. The call of the good falafel is the way to go.
Yeah.
I think that's all. Thank you very much.
Cool, thank you.
Okay, so I'm here with Murdoch, and Murdoch, can you explain a little bit about Rebel Press?
Rebel Press is an anarchist publishing group functioning out of the Trades Hall. I think it came in here in about 2007. Just recently it's been taken over by the people who run the Kate Sharpley Library, which is a kind of like an anarchist archive of a whole bunch of material. So there's There's the printer, there's a guillotine, there's a binder, everything you need to make a book. Yeah, that's Rebel Press.
So what do you think, in this age, I love asking people this, but in this age of sort of electronic publishing, and that seems to be where the democracy's going, what do you think paper has that perhaps, you know, starting a website or writing an e-book doesn't?
I'm not really sure. For me, I still read books in paper, and I had this problem with music when all my music was analog, and then I made it digital, and I feel like I've lost contact with a lot of it. There's not something existing in my house that reminds me of it. So with a paper book, I just like its physical presence. I like the way that, like, as a consumer of them, you're not tied to someone else's restrictions on how to share and how to lend and where to use them. I spend a lot of time offline and in places without Wi-Fi, and so I'm really acutely aware that, like, if you take all your music from Spotify and you don't have Wi-Fi, you're going to find yourself without music a lot of the time. So I feel, I mean, yeah, you can have your Kindle, and it's getting better and better, but I kind of like that idea that you buy the book and you become a little archivist, a little librarian yourself, and you've collected and collated these books that are important to you. And I got rid of a bunch of physical books recently, so I'm not that completely wedded to everything I own. I'm not hoarding them or anything, but I just like the idea of, and it's the kind of collector's fetish of having things, and I'm not against fetishism of objects.
Me neither. Why would there be an anarchist press? Why do anarchists need a press?
An anarchist press, like, anarchism is basically working together with your community to make things and to have control over those means of production. So it's kind of nice when, if everything is being centralized and print on demand aspects, and then they have a lot of control over how things are made, and they have control over the paper you use. So part of it is just, like, if you look at this paper we have here, this is 100% recycled paper. It's really high quality, beautiful stuff. And the same with the covers we print on. So we can make something that is a more beautiful item at the same time as having complete control and knowing that it can be here and we can make it on time. So, yeah, as a resource, like, I'm not sort of suggesting we're going to be in some dystopian centralized society in the future, but there's enough will for people to buy the stuff that comes out of that, and that supports this space existing for people to make books. I know in the past they looked at print-on-demand options, and the books look more authentic, like books. Like, often they look like things that will hold together more, and they have these little aspects to them, these little design aspects that, at least to me as a publisher, signify mass production, which can be kind of fetishized as the real book. But I think what we're producing now is solid, and it holds together, and it performs all the functions of a real book, but it has a different sort of marks on it, different guillotine marks. Like, if you look at the pages, you can see little parts where the printer has rolled through, little imperfections that are kind of beautiful. I mean, we can also do other things, like in this one we've got a little frontispiece with some red text on it, which, like, it's really expensive for us to print in all colour, but we can do other little things in the binding process because we're involved in all parts of it. Like, we could do, I was in a $2 shop the other day and they had this amazing glitter placemat, and I looked at it and I thought, we could cut that down and we could get 4 covers out of that. So we could make a glitter covered book.
What do you think, Brannavan?
Brannavan?
Glitter cover?
Yeah, we're going for glitter cover next one. Hey, because, yeah, I was noticing, it was so beautiful watching you guys work, because I was just noticing that you're putting that frontispiece in as you go. Like, it's such a physical kind of thing, isn't it? It's so different from sitting at home waiting for the boxes to arrive or something like that. Can you talk a little bit about your publishing company and, like, how did that start?
Lawrence & Gibson started 10 years ago in the Arrow Valley. And I was working with a fellow called Richard Meros who wanted to release his first book. And he had moved up along with myself and a few other friends from Dunedin, and we were all university friends. And there were people who had all the skills to release a book. But the book was, that was on the conditions and possibilities of Helen Clark taking me as her young lover. So it was kind of between a zine and a novella. And there was no real sense that a publisher, none of us knew publishers here. We didn't know Fergus or anyone else around. So we kind of had the sense that, oh, well, let's release it as a novella in the realm of zines. And so we thought, okay, well, let's just see if we can make it ourselves. It's not that hard. Like, a book is, Yeah, I know, like, people worship books, and they're like, oh, you wouldn't hurt a book. Look at that poor spine. But really, it's just, I mean, we print pages all the time. So really, it's just, like, paper, glue, cover. So, I mean, there was a lot of philosophy around it at the time of DIY and not wanting to be alienated from it, from that. I mean, there's a beautiful thing when the books do arrive, if you've got them ordered somewhere else and they come in and you open the box and you're like, ah, my books. But we get the same thing here once the final guillotine goes down on one. Brenovan or whoever the author is will look at it, and there's this moment where it hasn't looked like a book until that very moment. So then Lawrence and Gibson sort of, it started from these friends. We had designers and people doing editing and people doing marketing. And a lot of those people have come and gone now. Although Paul, who did the Designer Brands one, is still around. But we've sort of drawn in from our, you know, when you move to a city and you've got all your friends from before, but then you sort of expand out. And now all my Wellington friends and Brands Wellington friends are involved. And so the collective has become a more of a collective of writers who are interested in this kind of DIY stuff. And I don't know. Like, we try and publish books that are not, that are either, like, too, you know, I have to be careful with the words here. We publish books that probably wouldn't be welcome in other places because they're not commercially viable in a mass scale. Although I think Brenovan's new book really is. I think it's brilliant and really accessible. So I'm glad he didn't send that off to Fergus this time because we want it. Yeah, so it's now become this sort of group of us all in our early 30s or late 20s. And through friends of friends, we get new writers and encourage our other friends who might have written some short stories. If they've written a short story, why not try a novel? If you haven't written a short story, why not try that and see if you have that one idea and you can produce it into something. And we have the ability to get it out into bookstores and libraries. And yeah.
Can I ask a dirty question about money?
Yeah.
Can I ask about how you fund this, or how Lawrence and Gibson fund it, or how does it work?
We're a profit-maximizing corporation.
Ooh, I like it.
No, it's not true. One of the other glories of this is we can produce really good quality, good-looking books on a small scale. Like, we're only doing 160 now, but we've printed more covers so that in the future we can, like, we almost always print more. So it's easy to come in and print another 8 copies. You can see Brenovan's first one. We were sold out of it, and I just came in and made 8 more copies of it the other day. So instead of having to print 1,000 to get the economies of scale that would bring it down, we can actually produce books at about that cost, slightly more, but on a small enough scale that we don't have huge warehousing and we don't have an office. This is Rebel Press. Our storage is mostly with myself and my big old house. So it pays for itself. We sell a bunch through our website, we sell a bunch at launches, and then we sell a bunch through the sort of typical retail and library networks. And, yeah, we don't have a problem with money at all. Plus, we're not doing it for the money. Like, the authors, because they take part in it, their labor, they get half of any profits we make from their books. And the other half goes to Lawrence and Gibson. And over the 10 years, we've got plenty of money now. We don't actually know what to do with it. Like, we advertise a little bit, but mostly we just have a fund in case one of our books completely fails. I mean, we've had a couple about 6 years ago that we lost money on, but mostly they cover themselves.
And I guess that's a nice thing of thinking of it as a, I was just thinking, like, that umbrella of the publishing company is quite nice, isn't it? Because then you can, like, shift money around. You know, if there was something that looked completely unviable, it's nice to have some things that, you know, like, you can, yeah, you know what I mean, eh?
Yeah. I mean, things that are unviable, I kind of have a feeling that, I mean, we do like novel. We publish novels mostly, and we do like things with a bit of a narrative, but like A.D. Jameson's Giant Slugs was really experimental and I thought was really brilliant, but we didn't think it would sell many copies, and so we can kind of produce enough to meet that. Yeah, it's, I don't know. There's something viable. I think our books are enjoyable by people who like literature and who like some experimental narrative and who like words that aren't dumbed down, like books that aren't dumbed down in any way.
That sounds great. And so main sales come through. The website's quite interesting. Like, that sounds like it works well.
Yeah, it works well for pre-sales and for people who are overseas and around. And now that we've got 21 books in our catalogue, the back sale, like, it always just ticks through. Like, every week I'll be sending something off in the post. And, you know, I just take care of that.
It's quite incredible. Like, I don't know, like, it really makes me excited in this day of sort of crowdsourcing and all that sort of thing. Like, there's something really exciting about something that can kind of fund itself, you know. And, yeah, I find that quite exciting.
Yeah, me too. It's, I mean, we're doing this for the love of it because all of us enjoy writing, enjoy having books out there, being part of the collective we've got in the broader writing community in Wellington. You know, a lot of those, that's just pre-sales. Most of the time when you're selling a book through Kickstarter or Pledge Me, it's pre-sales of a text. And so we just, because we have got, you know, a few thousand dollars in the bank, we just underwrite that ourselves because we believe that the books will sell to people, whether it's through Unity or at the launch or online.
So where's the launch for this book?
The launch is at 17 Tory Street.
Yeah. Another exciting space.
Yeah, yeah, it is. It's nice being in. So I'm one of the people that run that space as well. So it's pretty good to be able to have that. And we've got a couple of bands on. So it's on the 3rd of June. We've got Ruth Mundy playing, who's an amazing singer-songwriter, and Vaughan, who's an amazing singer-songwriter. Is he a singer? Yeah. Do you know Vaughan? Yeah.
Yeah, we can call him that.
Yeah. And then Bran will do a reading. We kind of like the idea of not having a launch event where it's the publisher speaking and then someone else speaking and then the author reading. So we have that aspect of it, but we try and have a party as well. So lots of booze, some food, but not a huge platter, and some music. And, you know, people are going there to see one another and to talk, and our group of friends and the people who really like our books always come along. It's always a really good party. And it's kind of a slightly more youthful thing than a lot of the book launches at some of the other places, which is, you know, them kids, they like to party.
And one last thing. Do you take open submissions, or do you commission books, or how does that work?
Yeah, it's a mix. We sort of hide, I don't know where the email address is on the website at the moment. We do get quite a few submissions, and we haven't had that many successes of just people coming in because we're very specific about the kind of things we want to publish. So it is open, and I think I've had about four so far this year, but there are people who don't really understand the style of books we're doing. Like, we don't really do genre-based novels, and we do want books that are testing in a way. Whether that's with the quantity of syllables in them, that don't shy away from some intellectualism. You know, And we also, I don't know if it's commissioned, but like the next book we've got coming out is from a friend of mine who wrote it overseas last year, and I've been working with him for maybe 8 months since he submitted the first draft. I'm really trying to push that through to something that I would really want to publish. Like, it's a great book, it's a great concept, but it's his first book, and there's always that anticipation with a first novel that you just want it out there, you just want it done. So in a sense, it's not really commissioned. We wouldn't pay money to start with, and we wouldn't guarantee that we'd publish it, but I would work with the person, and say Branavin's looking at this other book as well. So yeah, there's enough of a collective that it's, what's a better term than commission?
I don't know, coddling
or cuddling, but neither of those.
Coddling or cuddling is the new, I think that's the new commission. Well, it just sounds like there's a community, you know what I mean? Like, it sounds like there's a community of people with, you know, maybe common aims and common enjoyments, you know, like they seem to enjoy similar things, and yeah, it just sounds great.
Yeah, it is great. You've got a community. Like, we've all got communities, and our friends are interested in writing, and they would edit a book. I'm sure if you wanted to work in a really similar way, you would think of someone to do a design, you would think of someone who would edit it, and taking out the kind of profit equation from it all. I mean, we all have regular jobs. Yeah. Do you have a regular job?
Oh, I so have a regular job. I teach at universities. That's my regular job.
Oh, yeah.
It's a great job. It's a very good job.
Yeah, it's a good gig. I mean, the university model is also great. I don't know what the finances are like between VUP and Victoria, but I think it's great that a university can also be that umbrella and to basically guarantee the existence of texts.
Yeah, I think you're dead right. You're dead right. Thank you. Is there anything else you want to tell me?
We are open to to more writers coming in. Part of it is they kind of need to be here in Wellington, and they need to be willing to participate in this process. So we've had a lot of people be like, oh, yeah, I guess I could fly down for a weekend and help out. But we actually want people who are like, yeah, that sounds awesome. We like the anarchist style of publishing. We like the idea we could be involved in it. We don't... You know, there's sort of some grandiose ideas amongst writers that, you know, you finish your masterpiece and then you send it off and then it appears in some bestsellers list, which is fine, but... No, there's something I don't like about that. Like, why is a book any different from some other item that you produce? Why don't you want to know more about how it's made? Like, there's something always beautiful about getting away from that, I don't know, that fantasy of distance.
Yeah, I totally agree. I was lucky enough to work with Kerry Ann Lee on a project last year, and we kind of sat in a room kind of similar to this and photocopied and stuck things together and stapled, and it was the best day of my life. It was just so great.
Best day of your life.
The best day of my life. Oh, daughter, rah. But, you know, just even watching Branavan and you here, I mean, it just, I don't know, like, yeah, this is wonderful. Thank you so much for having me here.
Oh, it's lovely. My pleasure.
Thanks heaps.
Something. You're smart, right? Do that thing!
Okay, good morning, Branavan.
Morning, Pip.
How are you?
Very well, how are you?
It's very good, it's very good. It's very nice to be here. And nice to
Thanks
be
for having
here
me.
With Aurelia as well. Hello. She's very cute. Okay, so, exciting times. I was wondering if you could maybe talk to me a little bit about, like, where the idea... Like, I'm wondering if the political impulse for the book and the creative impulse for the book arrived at the same time, or if that's a ridiculous binary that I'm building.
I think it did. So the whole idea for the book came from, I was talking to a friend who knew someone at the GCSB, and the rumour is, and I don't know if it's true, that whenever someone answers the phone at the GCSB, they have to stand up to tell everybody else that they're on the phone, which... struck me as hilariously paranoid. I don't know if it's true. In fairness to the GCSB, they might sit down when they take the calls. But that idea was the kind of start of the book. But there was so much happening around the world in terms of the refugee crisis, in terms of Islamophobia, the Donald Trump rhetoric, and even here, the whole refugee rhetoric by the current government is based on Islamophobia. And so I was... had just finished my last book, I was ready to kind of think about what I was going to write next, and they both kind of coincided at the same time.
What year did you start writing it in?
Last year.
Yeah. Because that's something I'm really interested in, because I'm really interested in contemporariority. Made up that word. No, I don't know if that's a word, but I'm really interested in that thing where sometimes... if you're writing about current issues, you have to turn things around relatively quickly, eh?
Yeah.
Like, you know, and what I really like about that, it means that you don't get to have any hindsight either. Yeah. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yep. I mean, it was interesting when I wrote the book, Paris had just happened. And when I finished the book, Brussels had happened. And so these two kind of huge media events had happened between the writing of the book. And... there is a sense of you write it and then you just hope that hindsight doesn't prove you wrong or shows you some other thing that you could have written about. But it also meant that I kind of had to get it out quickly. Well, I felt that I had to write it quickly so that it still felt relevant. And it still does, I think.
Yeah, definitely. Like, it was really funny because at one stage when I was reading it, I was thinking,
a dude who pulls ponytails? That's ridiculous. And then I thought, holy shit, that's John Key. And yeah, I just think I find it really exciting to read something that is turned around so quickly. So can you remember what your writing process was? Because you work pretty much full time, don't you? Mm-hmm. So what did that look like?
I spent a lot of time planning mm-hmm. and sorting out the narrative, and I always have an ending, so that's the kind of before I start, so that's what I always work to. And it's just a matter of me just writing whenever I can. Mm-hmm. I try not to set routines, because then I worry if I haven't met the routine, whereas if I just write whenever I'm able to write, I feel that's more productive for me. Personally, mm-hmm. that's just the kind of way I approach things. But then I also had a 3-week, the 4-week holiday over the summer break, mm-hmm. and I just wrote flat tack then. I also knew that Aurelia was coming in February, so I wanted to pretty much get as much done before she came along. So it's that kind of spurred things along. But it was just a matter of just writing whenever I can, and work just. I'd always concentrate on work during the day, and then as soon if I had the energy, just write in the evenings.
Mm, yeah, because and I guess, like, did you make a decision that the book would be set before you started writing, or in your imagination?
Yeah.
So you didn't include anything that kind of happened as you were writing.
It did. I had the narrative, but then I would just throw in things that would happen. As it went. The same thing happened with my Paris book, which was also written at the same time I was in Paris, and events such as, I think, there was a huge anti-marriage equality march in one of the last few days I was there in Paris. I was able to put that in time to get it in the book. And the same thing happened here, I think. I put in Paris, even though it wasn't necessarily at the start of my planning.
Yeah.
And there were a couple other things, I think. I can't remember when the ponytail incident started becoming news, but... Yeah,
what a nightmare. So the book is full of, and that interview that you did with Murdoch's fantastic. I'll put a link to that on the show page. But you mentioned that there are a lot of characters that are perhaps not like you.
Yeah,
and I'm really interested in that, like personally as a writer. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think particularly McManus is. Mm-hmm. quite an amazing construction. Like, I just think the way that she is created is just so incredible. And I'm just wondering how you approach that. Like, first of all, like, why did she need to be a woman?
Yeah.
And secondly, like, yeah, like a little bit about how, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, people are do you want to talk mm-hmm. a little bit about that?
The reason why McManus was a woman, I wanted to stretch myself as a writer, mm-hmm. and I felt...
you are so happy.
the last book had two male characters, I wanted to try something new, Veronica in the Paris book was also a female protagonist, but also I had known about the Spy Review last year had made out that the institutions were very, very chauvinist and boys' club. And they're trying to encourage more women into the spy agencies. So I thought, well, why not throw a female protagonist into that environment? Also, in some respects, I was kind of looking at my own. On the one hand, I'm non-white, so I have the kind of things which come from not being treated as a non-white person. But I'm also male, and so I have the advantages of being a male, and I just wanted to kind of transplant that onto McManus, who's female, and the disadvantage of that, but also being white in the context of analysing a Muslim.
Sorry, I interrupted because I'm excited. But yeah, because I think that what I really was astounded by in the book is the way that she becomes more and more of an object, and my gaze on her, like, you have such good control of that boys' club that's operating around her, that I found myself more and more thinking of her, you know, less as a spy and more. And I just thought that was incredibly well done.
I kind of hear a lot from my female friends about what it's like working either in a bureaucracy or in a private sector, and I get it. I try to listen as much as I can, and I get that sense from them about the day-to-day frustrations and the banalities that they have to deal with. And so that kind of played into it. And also... most institutions I've ever worked in or been involved with or friends, whether it's artistic or university or private sector, always had kind of men at the top, so it wasn't too hard to come up with the boys club concept.
I'm just laughing because the thing is that is what, to see it as blatantly put down there, and you know, like it's interesting to think about how to talk, you know, is this book satire or is it humor or is it, and often when I was reading it I was thinking ha ha ha, and then I was thinking no, this is just the truth transcribed, you know, which I think is so interesting, especially with the Islamophobia that mm-hmm. comes through, and even the stuff about the environment, the anti-war protesters as well, like you just see things written down that you hear all the time, and there's such a power in doing that, isn't
yeah.
there?
Yeah, yeah. I'm hugely fascinated by the way language is used to define people. That's what I did my master's on, and it was in context of blackness and the way that concept was invented for the slave trade and how it's persisted from that point, and just the particular words and the everydayness of the perpetuation of those frameworks. And so I was definitely kind of conscious of that in the way I was writing the book, in terms of the way left-wing protesters and activists are treated, the way Muslims are depicted, and just in the very everyday way those kind of power dynamics are maintained.
Yeah, and kind of the internalization that McManus does yeah. of the sex, like there's a part where I think they're going to the pub and she thinks, oh, she doesn't want to look like a gossip, or she doesn't want to take too long in the toilet, or you know, and I just think it's just so well observed. And I mean, that's so, is it right, oh gosh, I don't even know, I'm really interested in humor, mm-hmm. and I'm really interested in kind of like how humor is sometimes not funny, but there's a structure of humor.
Yeah,
and I just wonder, can you talk a little bit about that, like mm-hmm. do you see this as an exception? Like, I know how I see it. I, you know, I thought it was very funny. But do you see it as a funny book? Or what? How can you approach writing it yep. as far as that goes?
Well, the starting point that I was thinking of with humour is a bit like an action film, where you've got these set pieces and you stop the narrative in order to tell a joke, or you stop the narrative in order to have a ride of a thriller sequence. And humour, the best humour, which I watched or enjoy the most, is stuff that is incorporated into the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's that whole debate versus in film, there's a massive debate between Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton as yeah. to who's the better. And people say, oh, Charlie Chaplin does amazing stunts, but his humour was set pieces and they didn't necessarily drive the narrative, whereas Buster Keaton's stunts drove the narrative. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to do that with the humour. So hopefully, I was also trying to use the awkwardness, the pauses that you get from humour within the narrative. So there was the telephone call to the police, was the worst possible time for the narrative to be stopped, but I thought it would be a perfect time to put it in. And so I definitely was trying to write it funny, but I was also trying to make the kind of humour shift from being something that's funny, haha, to a bit like, oh, really? I shouldn't be laughing at it.
Because I think the awkwardness is just unbelievably well controlled as well. And, like, so I guess, like, I don't know, there's something terrifying about telling a joke and no one laughing.
Yep.
So, and I guess when you're writing, we only, you know, we're our readers when yep. we write. So were you laughing while you were writing, or were you, is there a note that sort of hits you inside and you go, oh yeah, that's funny?
A little bit. I used to, so I've written hopefully what I consider humorous pieces since I was 18, 19 when I was writing for Salient.
Yeah.
And back then, I had this kind of naive and stupid idea that humour is, well, a joke is a joke, and it doesn't matter, you can cut anybody down, and it's all the same. And it wasn't until I'd done my master that I'd realised about the power dynamics and the way you can use humour as a way of exposing certain hierarchies, etc. So I feel like, because I've been writing humour for a long time, I feel like I've got a relatively good sense of what I would consider funny. But what I consider funny is not necessarily the same as what an audience member will consider funny. I mean, I know the last one, a bunch of people found it really funny, but a bunch of people didn't find it funny at all. And it's
you thought it was funny.
It's one of those awkward things which you kind of hope that it works, but
yeah.
But also, if it's driving the narrative, then it doesn't necessarily matter as much if the jokes fall a bit flat.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's really true. Like, I'd never thought of like moving it around like that. What do you think, Aurelia? Good. Good. That's very good. Very good. Because, yeah, that whole... I had a really interesting discussion with Rachel O'Neill about humour, and I really liked how she talked about it. She sort of talked about how there has to be a real sort of understanding of culture to get humour. Like, and I think that's that other thing about contemporaneity in the day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, I've got friends from all kind of spheres of life, and I feel like I flit around between them all pretty well, so I get a pretty good overview of what some people find funny, what some people don't find funny.
Yeah.
And then I'm also a really conscious consumer of comedy that I think it's a really, just like anything, if you want to write good writing, you want to read as many good writers as you can. Same with comedy, I think. It's just watch as much comedy and, yeah.
Because it really does feel like we're at an absolute zenith of magnificent comedy, eh? Like, I've just been listening to a podcast with Louis C.K. talking about Horace and Pete,
mm-hmm.
and sort of the idea that, you know, it's a tragedy, not a comedy, you know, and I just feel like there's just so much experimentation with the genre of comedy.
Yeah.
What do you like?
I like the full gamut, right? Really silly comedy.
What do you like? She's so cute.
Hello.
Yes.
she's quite chatty. I also really like awkward comedy. So, The English Office, as much as I now hate Ricky Gervais, was just a perfect piece of comedy in terms of the way it used awkwardness to drive the narrative, and the way it had the character, maybe the male characters in particular, were so well drawn. And the satire was just hitting just really hard. And it came out when I was 18, so it was just, you know, those kind of things which help spur you on in terms of the artistic process. I really love the Richard Pryors and the people like that, who just could spin a huge narrative and you're not sure if it's funny.
You are funny. You're so cute. Oh, you're coming up here now. Oh, look. What's happening now? Oh, man. She is so cute.
But I love the Richard Pryor and the way they can spin a narrative, and you're not sure if it's funny, but overall it's just incredibly. I mean, he's literary in the way he writes his stand up, and just even the local stuff. I mean, Eamon Murrah I think is just amazing, and he has that amazing ability to go between sad and funny, often at the same time, and so that sort of stuff was definitely. Influential,
because I think that's one of the real powers of your book as well, is that swing between laughing and crying, you know. Like I think, you know, like sort of saying ha 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 and then like, oh, this country, you know, like, sorry. I think that might be my national anthem.
Yeah.
Oh, this country.
I mean, I try to be very moral in my comedy. People occasionally misread it to think that I'm mocking kind of the powerless, which is definitely not what I'm what I'm trying to do, but I hopefully it's kind of funny, but also just like, ooh, yeah, this is I mean, I'm picking my targets with this one.
Yeah, because I mean that is a really interesting thing, eh? Like that risk in comedy of being misunderstood, eh? And I think it's a risk in all literature, you know. Like I've had it, you know, like I've had people misread me, well, not misread me, you know, they've read it and they've found that, and that's cool, you know, like that's great, but it's, you know, kind of upset me a little bit.
Yeah.
And there is, but I mean, I guess the other alternative is to stay safe, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I guess, yeah.
I'm small fry enough that I have no real need to just stay safe. It's not like I have anything to lose with my writing, so the last one, I got away with it in terms of not being sued by the finance company involved. So I feel like I'm getting more and more reckless.
I am on fire. Can you talk a little bit? I'm really interested in this veil that sort of falls down between reality and fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering, in your mind, how does this book relate to reality?
Right? Yeah, I mean, because it's a fictional agency. Yeah, it's it's... There's enough, well, I try to use enough that's recognisable. I'm not quite writing social realism, but that's definitely more what I'm influenced by than than anything else. And I'm also very interested in the banal and the everyday in it. So I think everyday life would feed into it much more than perhaps just me making some things up completely. Yeah. The only time I think I kind of went beyond that would have been in the second book, where I had the ghosts appear.
Yeah.
But apart from that, I'm very much focused by the here and now and real life.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess I kind of trained as a journalist, or did like journalism have a journalism background, so that might feed into it a little bit.
Yeah. Because, I mean, that's what I really love about going back in your catalogue. Is that a music term? But, you know, like going back is that, you know, like... the Paris book, I always call it the Paris book. But, you know, like, that is such a beautiful moment frozen in time now, you know what I mean? And I feel like this will be a moment frozen in time as well.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, what... You know, a lot of people, like... oh, gosh, I'm going to totally put words in people's mouths, but I do get a sense that there's a slight fear of writing the contemporary.
Yep, I think so.
And I'm wondering why. Don't know.
Is there a fear that it dates? I mean, that could be the major fear. I mean, in 10 years' time, me writing about a boss who pulls ponytails might seem really naff, just as it might even be naff right now.
Because they all might be doing it
by
then, you know, like there'll be an imbecile in every prime ministerial post
and
in the world.
And we've gone through a few election cycles and a few prime ministers, so, you know, then you don't really want it to be of the time. But then, I don't know, it's kind of some of the best comedy, comedic books that I like were of the time, but also still stand out. So things like Confederacy of Dunces and Catch 22
so
and
good.
Nabokov and all the Victorian English writers. And yeah,
I think it's so true, eh? Like, I just, I don't know. Like, yeah, I think you're right. Like, I mean, that fear of dating, I mean, even when you look at something like Infinite Jest, like the thought that it would be a cartridge, you know, that beta was going to be where we, you know, that was going to be the ultimate in video with these massive cartridges. You know, yet there's something beautiful about that. I don't know. I really, really love it. Can you talk a little bit about writing community? Like, have you always written in Wellington?
I have, yep. So I grew up in Wellington, grew up in the hut and moved to Wellington when I was at uni. And I had a kind of salient community. We kind of all did stuff together, but not necessarily fiction or anything like that. Most of them went into journalism.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had the kind of Lumiere community, so a bunch of reviewers and a few of them went on to do some amazing stuff, like Amy Brown and Catherine Bisley and people like that, who kind of gone on to be creative whilst also doing reviews. So I had that, and then I met Murdoch in 2010 and kind of been introduced to his community, and Wellington's great in terms of everyone's so supportive, and no one really cares about what you'd write about. They just kind of want to help out, and that's been really fantastic.
Yeah. I'm trying to go back. Is this the first book you've set in Wellington?
It is the first book.
Thinking, am I wrong here? So what? Obviously, it's the capital.
Yeah.
But what is that? What does that mean to write about the place that you live in?
Well, I think it's interesting because the first two books were about Kiwis overseas and them trying to figure out what's going on or where they are. And also you see it with fresh eyes. So this was me forced to see a city with fresh eyes, which I'm so used to and so aware of all the nooks and crannies and know how to get from places and not worry too much about it. But I was also going out a lot and kind of seeing the city and trying to get a new sense of it. And so it was a bit of a shift, trying to get me to get out of my complacency with the city and try to re-engage with it. But it was definitely a fun thing to do.
Yeah, I really like the idea of sort of being a tourist in your own city. Like,
yeah.
It's pretty, I don't know, and Wellington, it seems, again, just the perfect time to write a novel about Wellington, just the way that I do feel like it's shifting, you know, like the public systems being, public services being absolutely gutted, and, you know, there's been a lot of anti-Wellington rhetoric and that sort of thing, so it does, you know, like your prime minister loves and lives in Auckland, you know, like, and It seems like there's such a perfect time to talk about Wellington, eh?
Yeah, and I think it's also a pretty misunderstood city by people who aren't from Wellington. I don't necessarily present Wellington the best light in this book, but it's also a city which I think's great. It's multicultural. It's really intelligent, and there's so much stuff going on. I mean, I lived in Paris, and I can't keep up with everything that's happening in Paris, but I still can't keep up with everything that's happening in Wellington. Yeah, I feel like there's this kind of people think that we're snobs and all about our $10 coffees and craft beer and all that sort of thing, which is totally not the case.
I think it's really interesting. I really I often see you at music things.
Yeah.
And I'm interested in, you know, like, I find, you know, that's another great thing about Wellington, is that there really is beginning to be this quite incredible sort of music stuff going on, and like music that seems to centre often around performance and stuff as
yep.
well, which is so interesting. Can you talk a little bit about that? Mm-hmm. Like, what is it for a writer to engage with music?
Yeah. Well, my original background was music and film. That was where I started doing creative work and also then writing about it. And so my writing started from those two things in particular. And I tutored in the popular music paper at Vic for 4 years, and I did my master's in popular music, so music has always been this huge thing. And then I'm also really fascinated by the way music plays a role within society, because it's much more of a popular art form than anything else. But also Wellington has, from the moment when I was able to go to bars, has always had this really great scene. Artists are doing amazing stuff, but also doing it despite not getting any money for it, or just doing it just because they love it. And I find that really, really, really inspiring, because it's all about the creation and the performance that's not necessarily, and they're making great stuff out of it. There's a level of sophistication that I find in Wellington music that you don't necessarily see in other places. And I think New Zealand overall, the music punches above its weight. And so all of that, and the sense of community you get from going to gigs, and the friends who, I've got a group of friends who we always go to gigs together, or have always gone to gigs together, that kind of stuff has helped a lot in terms of me wanting to do my own creative thing.
Yeah, because you, and the thing is, I'm just thinking about the things I've seen you at, you seem very democratic in your tastes, which often, I mean, you often don't find in music. You know, people often define themselves by what they hate, kind of, you know, and like, but it's really, I'm just looking back and thinking, I think I saw you at Neutral Milk Hotel, but I think I also saw you at Run the Jewels, so there's, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think I try to push myself out of my comfort zone as well, and I think if you talked to me as an 18-year-old, I would have had all of these barriers about what music I listen to, what I wouldn't like, and I was really opinionated and really kind of thinking, yeah, my music's so much better than yours, kind of vibe. But then also, once I started tutoring in the popular music paper and just getting the sense of passion from people who were really into nerdcore or really into black metal or really into stuff that I hadn't listened to, meant that I was like, oh, I need to kind of expand my own horizons. And also, I just try to consume as much as I can in terms of music and film and art. I try not to say this is what I like and this is only what I'll consume. I'm happy to challenge myself and figure out, and because also I have this view that even if I don't like something, there's always something that I'm going to get out of it, and so that's kind of helped inform what I see and what I go to and what I try to consume.
Because that's, I mean, like, I think we're quite similar in that way, because even if I'm watching something that isn't engaging me or listening to something that isn't engaging me, it's really interesting to what, then you get a better view of what's going on.
Yep.
Like, you're sort of like, oh, they're doing that, and they're sort of it's quite incredible. Have you made film?
I have, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I made a few short films. I also made a feature when I was at uni, which is terrible and hasn't really seen the light of day, but but everyone kind of really pitched in, did a great job, so it was heaps of fun to be involved with. But also, I don't think I had the energy and the drive to keep doing it. It's a remarkably high intensity kind of profession, and I'm amazed at the people who do it regularly. So I that was my original background, but then in honours I did a script writing paper, and I loved the writing far more than I like the creating part. So
yeah, it's interesting, eh? Like at point, because I went to film school as well, and like it's that interesting point where the writing takes over, eh?
Yeah.
And like always I'm sort of like, I keep looking at all this amazing web series work that's going and keep thinking, oh my goodness, I want back in. And you know like Tangerine last year, which was made with an iPhone, and I'm just like, oh my god, I don't need big gear anymore. And but I can't imagine a moment where I would make that, where I would be willing to be away from writing like short stories and fiction long enough to make something like that. Are you a web series or something?
Well, I mean this book, for example, definitely thought cinematically in the way that how it might play out in a film. I think the last one too. I don't think I have the ability or the kind of patience to do it. I mean, the way I've been able to write is because I can snatch an hour in an evening, or I can snatch 2 hours and on a Saturday morning or something like that, whereas with film you just really have to throw yourself into it.
And then there's the organisation that, you see, that's what I find really interesting, is like, I'm obsessed with TV and film, I'm obsessed with music, they're collaborative things. And then I'm always like, where do I get my collaboration when I'm writing? Like, where do I get, because I love, you know, my favourite thing is to work with other people on something, but, you know, writing, you know, in the cliched way is a solitary thing. But yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, I definitely try to collaborate as much as I can in my writing. Obviously, it is the solo, write at your own laptop kind of thing. But with the likes of Murdoch, with Robin, who's my editor, with Paul Neeson, who does the design, with the musicians who always play at my launches, and me going to their shows, and that stuff, I feel like, helps with my writing process. And so it's not necessarily a direct collaboration, but there's definitely a sense of us inspiring each other.
I really love that idea, because I'd never thought about that. Like, I always think collaboration is someone sitting beside me and us producing the same product. But I think you're dead right. Like, I mean, you know, even work, you know, like you'll talk to people and that conversation will spark something. And like you say, I really love the way you talk about music, because, you know, like, you know, I'll see someone perform, you know, and I'll think, oh yeah, that's right, I remember that is what we're aiming for, you know. Like, it's not, you know, and I just think, yeah, it's pretty amazing, eh?
Well, music has that immediate reaction, you get such immediacy to it, whereas a book is so much more slow burning usually. Sometimes you get a great passage and you're just like, oh, this is just the best, but it is a totality far more so than a song can be, and maybe it's kind of using the two together, you've got the two extremes. And
that's so true. I never thought of that, like the way that, you know, like, I guess because I've got a friend who's a singer, and she often says that, she says, how do you know you're going right if you haven't got an audience to tell you that you're going right? And, you know, even comedians, like, I remember I was really interested in stand-up a few years, like I still am, but I just got a bit obsessed with it and was reading how everyone writes their stand-up, and it was really interesting. They were kind of like, oh, I try the jokes out on an audience. I'm just like, that's astounding, you know. I am my audience, you know, in this really weird narcissistic kind of way. And yeah, I don't know, like, I guess that's the thing, like, to be around people. Because, I mean, there is a temptation, isn't there, to sort of write about writers or write about, which, you know, I think that's what's so great about, like, if you look at it, and again, this morning I was sort of looking back at your books, and, like, it's just bizarre where they go. Like, it's just incredible. And do you have any ideas at the moment? Yeah, I know you haven't even launched this one, but are you thinking about
next books? I've got the germ for the next one. I was talking to a cleaner after the big floods last year. The motorways got shut, and so the entire city was just panicked trying to get out of Wellington back to the hut, or back to Porirua or Whitby or up wherever. But these cleaners were struggling to get into town to do their job. And only 3 out of the 12, I think, when I was talking, the cleaner that I was talking to, he said that only 3 out of the 12 were able to make it because of all the public transport closures. And they all worked ridiculous hours that night, do as much of the building as they can, but even then, obviously, with just three people doing something that 12 people would do, you don't do that great a job. And they got a whole bunch of complaints from businesses and companies all around the city about how they didn't do the job properly. And then just tying that with the precariousness of zero-hour contracts and people who don't have the ability not to show up because everyone in Wellington was able to leave at 2 o'clock because they needed to get home, whereas people didn't necessarily have that choice. But also sending it within a refugee as the cleaner, and maybe getting in touch a little bit with my Sri Lankan heritage, which I haven't done at all with my writing.
God, that sounds fantastic. I've been asking people this as a dumb question, but if you could change one thing about New Zealand tomorrow, what do you think is the most pressing problem we've got at the moment?
A lack of compassion would definitely be very high.
It's astounding, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's worrying.
Yeah.
I keep hoping that I'm being exposed to the wrong types of reactions. Because I was just thinking about the home, the crisis that's happening in Auckland, which is not a crisis. Yeah. Everything's fine.
But we'll get rid of the council, but it's still not a crisis.
Everything's fine.
Yeah.
I must admit, I can't believe... people don't seem to be able to shift their experience, do they? And I think that's the power of fiction. Like, I know that's a really kind of... you called it utopian, but, it is quite a... Pollyanna-ish kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I mean, that is one of the things, and I think that's what's one of the huge successes of Briefcase is that, you're not showing unusual things, but you're showing them in a way that makes you look at them skew, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I think also, my fascination with these grand narratives and these discursive frameworks of which perpetuate misogyny and homophobia and racism, etc., while they are defined by people who have power, they are also perpetuated by people on the street every day, people who might say a passing comment which is really cruel or etc. And it just happens on a day-to-day basis, which is cynical on the one hand because it means that we ourselves are responsible for racism and sexism, etc. But also, hopefully, it means that it's within our power then also to change the narrative and change those ideas. That you can, if it's with us who get to perpetuate the power structures, it's also our ability to shift it. So maybe that's where the compassion can come in, the inability to, acknowledging that we have no right to define someone else. Those kind of ideas hopefully might start shifting those ideas a bit.
Because I must admit, it does give me a lot of hope. And I think that was what was really good about the book as well, is that it's set in a very hierarchical... my anarchist is showing. But, and you can see that, Paulson does something, then Potter does something, then, McManus does... You know what I mean? Like, you just see it throwing down the line. And the language... You can even see people trying to use the language for power and the horrible, the languages that are reinforcing these things to try and get themselves back up, Ugh.
I'm also really fascinated by minute interactions. I think there's an overemphasis of... government power bashing down on the weak... weak person, whereas I'm much more interested in how we all have the capacity to perpetuate these ideas and also just how banal it can be, how sexism is so everyday, and just reading those accounts, etc., just makes it all that apparent.
Oh my god, I didn't expect us to go here. I'm liking it though. What is it to be a political writer in New Zealand today? Like, is there such a thing? Would you consider yourself...
I think so. Murdoch and I were talking about this the other day, and how it's part of Lawrence Gibson's ethos to publish books that are generally political. And I know there's a couple other books that they're considering this year which are also quite political and have have a kind of a, not necessarily a status quo narrative. I don't know. I feel like... that's my obligation as a writer. I remember thinking when John Campbell was getting the boot from MediaWorks, and everyone was like, "Oh no, but who's going to give the voice to the to the oppressed and the who's going to kind of talk about community. I was like, well, isn't that what we as artists should also be doing?
Yeah.
That's our obligation too. I mean, it was really sad about John Campbell and he was great, but also that's what we should be doing too. And I feel like with that kind of idea in mind, there was no choice but to be a political writer. I don't know what that means in terms of audience and readership and whether that means I'm going to be marginalised or people just think, oh, I'll just ignore him as a writer because I'd rather read something that's comforting than challenging. But I don't know. I'm kind of trying to be as true to myself as I can in terms of what I write.
Yeah, I think I agree. Like, I totally agree. I completely agree. And I think, you know, there's risk in that. You know, like, I mean, you know, like, especially in a country where arts are government funded. And, you know, like, and I think, but I really liked what you said in that interview with Murdoch. Like, and when my daughter's 15 years old, I don't want her to look back and see that I was writing, you know, stuff that says, everything's great, you know, oh my goodness, you know. And I think, yeah, I think there is an obligation, isn't there? Like, because, you know, I really do think fiction has power. And I think art has abilities that we don't. It was really interesting because I went to a thing on climate change the other day, and a thing on climate change. It was the most depressing thing I've ever been to. It was the first one I've ever been to where they were talking about designing for sea level shift. You know? So it's like we're not even trying anymore.
Yeah.
But they were saying there that in order for anything to change, people have to change their minds, and nothing changes their minds like art. You know, like science isn't as successful at changing minds as art.
Yeah.
And I just thought, wow, there's hope.
It's yeah.
been great.
Well, even if we don't necessarily change things, we also get to define a time. And we get to define this current government, for example. That's our right. No one's going to read a political journalist's article from this time in 20 years' time, but they will read a novel or hear an album or something that's of this era. Yeah. And I don't want this fucker to be defined by his popularity ratings. I'd rather do the defining. So I think there's also that sense of you can be political in a way of just you don't get your legacy, this is your legacy.
I never thought of it like that, but it's so true. Oh, thank you so much.
No, thank you for having me.
What a great way to start the day. Aurelia's gone to sleep.
Yeah,
she's amazing. You're so cute. Does she give you much time to write?
I haven't written since, but I also, this is my period of reading and trying to plan what I'm writing about. And,
oh, cool.
I have a kind of general fixed routine of 6 months research, 6 months writing, 6 months editing.
That sounds really great.
But it's not necessarily always, doesn't necessarily always work out like that, but that's what I try to do.
And so when you read, sorry, we're back again. I said goodbye and thank you. But so when you read, do you read around what you're writing? Do you think to yourself, oh, I want it to sound a bit like X, so I'll go and read X? Or...
No, I try to, well, in that first 6 months, I try to read anything and everything that I can. I also had, because I catalogue everything that I read, and I also realised that I don't read anywhere near enough female writers, I don't read anywhere near enough non-white writers, post-colonial fiction. So this time around, I've definitely, also because I'm writing about a female Sri Lankan character, I'm just trying to read as much... not tied around a particular voice or theme or anything, but just writers of which aren't my traditional canonical writers. So it's similar to my music approach. I just try to read anything, and I try not to have a kind of set idea of what I want to read, but then when I'm actually writing, I tend to focus in on particular voices that I'm trying to capture. Or...
I really like that. And is your planning done in notebooks, or do you that sounds great. Oh my goodness. Oh, I really like that idea. I think that I can see, I don't know, like I had a year last year where I realized I hadn't read a female writer for a long time.
Yeah.
And I had a year where I tried to read only women and it didn't work, like because things came up, but I still managed to swing the scale slightly, you know what I mean? Which made me really happy. And also made me disgusted at myself.
Yeah,
like I just thought, what the?
I realized this in 2013, and I was like, yeah, what have I been doing? I've just bought into the whole ridiculous canon idea. So for the last one, I definitely was reading about 70% female writers.
Yeah.
I think it hopefully has shifted. Well, I mean, also each book has a completely different voice, and I very much think about the voice before I write, and so this one had a pretty neutral, straightforward voice, whereas the last one was, I was trying to capture a voice of guilt, and that's why I had these long sentences which just rambled. And the previous one was the voice of surveillance and staccato sentences. And I by reading as much as I can, hopefully that helps with shifting voices around.
Yeah. And I was just thinking about that thing about comfort, and I was thinking about how, you know, there is this, like, I've totally bought into it too. What, you know, like, I'm finding myself at the moment really suspicious of the word good writing. And yeah because what I've found is that when I make those great shifts, like when I decide to read things in translation, or I decide to read, you know, people writing in English, when, you know, and like, yeah, there is a shift that's needed. There's an aesthetic shift sometimes.
Yeah.
And, like, I just feel like I've been so sold a bill of goods. You know what I mean? Like, I'm just like, this is good writing. You know, like, we don't talk about ourselves. We don't, you know, it's showing, not telling. You know, all this stuff. And I just think, God, it's just crazy.
Yeah, I mean, this may come out in my own writing, but I have no interest in aesthetic writing if it's not telling anything. And I'd much rather have a book which is terribly written but has these amazing ideas, just as I love raggedy noise on and feedback on music, or just tapeists or stuff like that, or bad camera shots. I'm far more interested in imperfections, and I think that's a far more interesting aesthetic than something that's perfect.
Yeah, I totally agree. Like, I'm at my happiest when I'm reading or listening to something and I can't tell if it's good or bad.
Yeah.
Like, I'm like, oh, this will go. I either think this is the best thing I've ever heard, or this is the worst thing. It's my favorite moment.
Yeah.
And there's not many people that can do it for me. But yeah, I do love it. Oh, okay. Thank you so much.
No, thank you.
Have a really good day.
Their children on a boat unless the water is safer than the land. Not so hard to grasp, not so hard to understand. But it's easier to sit and read this shit in the paper and call it news. Like, oh, Prince George, he's so sweet. And 18 grand on a present's fine, even if the other 2-year-olds don't have enough to eat. It's easier to blame the people hiding in the hold of a plane and not consider what they left that was worse than almost certain death. It's easier to stick with what we learned, that our own good luck is something that we earn, that their kids don't deserve as much as yours. 'Cause yours were smart enough to be born on these shores. And it's easier to keep up the pretense that the way to solve displacement is to build another fence. It's easier to say I'm sorry, but she shouldn't have been on that lorry. It's easier to blame the dead if you don't find out their name. It's easier to stick with what we learned, that our own good luck was something that we earned. And what's with the way they want to live and give their children hope in hell? What's with them having degrees and families? It's almost like they're human. this world. But at least our leaders are on form. 'Cause it's always good to describe downtrodden people as a swarm. It's easier to be on the wrong side of history. It's easier to blame than be ashamed. It's easier to stick with what we learned, that our own good luck was something that we earned. But no one puts their children on a boat unless the water is safer than the land.
Oh my god, Kate Bush is so good. Why Kate Bush?
Exactly.
Why
great
not?
Question.
We have this theory, so we both love Kate Bush, but we also have the theory that, so this place is bugged.
Yes.
And it was bugged after the Wirrawirra raids.
Yeah, yeah.
And we had this theory that, well, I think, who was it? The Rebel Press guys had a theory that the spooks who listen in wouldn't be Kate Bush fans.
It's a good point. It's a really good point.
My theory was that it would be the correspondence that happens when you have two groups spending time around one another, and they subtly are infused with one each other's culture, and so that the cops would start humming along to Kate Bush. And then what the anarchists could do is have like a Kate Bush tribute night down in Happy when it was open, and you'd get all these cops sort of shuffling in because they're so much in love with Kate Bush, which is incidental music to their spying.
Oh my god, I so love it.
So that never happened, but that was the theory.
Well, there's still time. There's still time.
Yeah, well, we're still planning.